By the sovereignty of God is the truth of God's supremacy. He is the supreme ruler. He is the Most High God. And the opening words of our psalm summarize this truth when David says, "The Lord reigneth. The Lord reigneth." And you can think of that word sovereign containing the word reign. The sovereign indicates the reign of one who is supreme. The reign of one who is over all. He is supreme in his rule and in his reign over all things. He reigns according to his purpose. God has purposed, and according to that purpose, he rules. His purpose is determined by his pleasure. God has purposed according to his pleasure. Whatsoever the Lord pleased, that did he. Whatever God has done, whatever God is doing, whatever God will do, is according to his pleasure. He was pleased to do so. And whatsoever he has been pleased to do, his power will accomplish. Nothing can frustrate God's will, God's purpose, God's pleasure. You can see that in this opening verse. The Lord reigneth. He is clothed with majesty. The Lord is clothed with strength wherewith he hath girded himself. Whatsoever he has purposed according to his pleasure to do, his power will accomplish. And nothing can stop or hinder or frustrate the purpose of God. Now, God's sovereignty is evidenced in creation. He chose to create. It was God's good pleasure to create the world. He could have chosen not to create. To have dwelt forevermore, eternally, in the solitariness of his own being without creating. God did not need creation. He did not need to create. But he chose to create. And every aspect of creation manifests the sovereignty of God. The sky is blue because he chose it to be blue. The grass is green because he chose it to be green. He could have reversed that order. The sky could have been green and the grass could have been blue. But God chose to make them in that way. Every inch of space, every aspect of his creation manifests his sovereignty, that he does according to what he has been pleased to do. His sovereignty extends over all creation. Every inch of space is under his jurisdiction. Inanimate matter, the angelic world, the animal world, the world of mankind, they are all under God's sovereign reign, God's sovereign control. His sovereignty is witnessed also by his permission of evil. We looked at that last week. And how the Lord permitted evil to come into the world. Some people say, but is not evil a challenge to the sovereignty of God? Is it not an indication that things have gone out of control, that God's purpose has gone terribly wrong, and everything now is out of control because of evil, because of that spirit of rebellion, because of sin? The Bible makes it clear that God foresaw the evil that would come, and God permitted it, and God restrains it, and God brings good out of it, and God will ultimately and eternally triumph over evil. And therefore, the very fact that evil has been permitted is an evidence of the sovereignty of God. He permitted angels and men to follow the evil desire that originated in their hearts. God is supreme. God is sovereign over all things. Now tonight I want us to consider this truth in another way. Another way in which the sovereignty of God is manifested. And that way is in relation to the revelation of God's law. God's law. God, as the sovereign ruler of creation, has determined and fixed laws that govern his creation. And those laws reveal the fact that he is sovereign. that he's over all, and that he does according to his pleasure. You can think of what is referred to as the laws of nature, those laws that govern the universe. And you think of how the earth rotates on its own axis once every 24 hours, and then the earth rotates around the axis of the sun once every year. That is always ongoing. That is the law that God has created for this planet and many other laws for the universe, laws of nature. I think it's better to refer to them as the laws of God that govern nature, that govern his creation. God made those laws and he set those laws in place. And the universe operates according to those laws. But in a similar manner, God has fixed laws for the world of mankind. The first of which is, thou shalt have no other gods before me. That is God's law. And God has fixed his law in this world to govern and regulate mankind. And therein he has manifested the fact of his sovereignty. The law of God manifests and illustrates the fact that he is sovereign. He is the supreme ruler. He's over all. And he does according to his purpose and his good pleasure. Now, if you stop to think about that, and you stop to think about the law of God in that aspect, it reveals different things. First of all, we can see how the sovereignty of God is manifested by the testimony of the law. God's law testifies and bears witness to the fact that God is sovereign. It is the expression of God's rule, the expression of God's right to direct us as to what we do and what we are not to do. That's what the law of God is. The law of God tells us what we're to do and what we're not to do. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not steal. Honor thy father and thy mother. What is God doing? He's directing us what we are to do and what we're not to do. And therein, he is manifesting his sovereignty over us. The law is the evidence that God is king, that he reigns over us. He prescribes what is right and what is wrong. He tells us how we are to live in relation to doing those things that please him and those things that displease him. James chapter 4 and verse 12 tells us that there is one lawgiver. One lawgiver. Only one. What an interesting little verse that is. He says in the verse 11, speak not evil one of another, brethren. He that speaketh evil of his brother and judgeth his brother speaketh evil of the law and judgeth the law. But if thou judge the law, thou art not a doer of the law, but a judge. There is one lawgiver. There's the idea of sovereignty, of supremacy. There's only one who can determine the law, who can give that direction as to what we're to do and what we're not to do. There's only one lawgiver who is able to save and to destroy. God is the lawgiver, and the law that he has given expresses his sovereignty over us. If you look at Isaiah chapter 33, notice this description is given again. The lawgiver, and this time it is associated with authority, with kingship. Isaiah 33 and the verse 22, for the Lord is our judge. The Lord is our lawgiver. The Lord is our king. The lawgiver is the king, the sovereign, the supreme ruler. The one who has authority over us. Authority to direct us and to show us what we should do and what we should not do. So, the law of God reveals God's authority over us. It reveals his sovereignty. It reveals his kingship. It reveals his authority. and it reveals the fact that his authority is absolute. There's no dispute with God. There's no disputing or questioning his law. There's no right of appeal against what God has commanded. His law is absolute. His law is final because he is sovereign. He is supreme. We live in an age that is characterized by rebellion against God's authority. Man challenges the authority of God. One of the most prominent aspects of this rebellion is the denial of absolutes. There is, they claim, no absolute right or no absolute wrong. Men have devised their own relative morality. Their morals are determined by their own judgments, by their own estimation, so that every man does whatever he thinks is right in his own eyes, according to his own judgment. There's no supreme law governing all. It's really up to the individual what he thinks is right for himself. And what he thinks is right for himself may not be right for somebody else, and somebody else determines what's right for him. And so you've got relative morality. Morality is dictated by man's will, by man's opinion, and by man's judgment. It's really the rejection of God's revealed law. The rejection of God's revealed law. And the rejection of God's law is nothing else than a rejection of God's sovereignty, God's authority over us. We must never forget this connection. Rejection of God's law is the rejection of God's sovereignty. It is man saying, I am my own king. I am my own ruler. I am my own master. God has no right to rule over me. God has no right to dictate to me what I should do and what I shouldn't do. When men despise and reject God's law, it is only the expression of their rebellion against the sovereignty of God. But the law of God testifies to God's sovereign authority over us. He determines what is right and what is wrong. There's only one lawgiver. It's not up to me to determine what's right or what's wrong. It's not up to somebody else to determine what's right or what's wrong. God is the lawgiver because he is sovereign. He determines what's right and what is wrong. He decrees how we are to live, how we are to act, how we are to behave, because he is sovereign. He's the sovereign God. And his law testifies to his sovereignty. And you can go through the scriptures and just find how many, many times the word law occurs. And every time you find that word law, it's just pointing to the fact that God is sovereign. God has absolute authority over us. God reigns. God rules. God can direct us what we are to do and what we're not to do. How we're to live and how we're not to live. He is sovereign. The sovereign ruler. But then we learn of the sovereignty of God, not only in the testimony of the law, but in the transition of the law. And by that I mean the change in God's laws. When we speak about the law of God in general, it is in relation to sovereign authority over us. But when our focus turns to God's law in particular, to the particular requirements of God's law, we've got to be always careful to remember the two divisions into which God's law falls. The first is what we might refer to as natural laws, or those laws that are derived from God's nature. It is that rule of duty which God lays upon us that is founded in his unchangeable, holy and righteous nature. Take the first commandment, thou shalt have no other gods before me. That is a commandment that comes out of God's nature. The reason why we're to have no other gods is because there is no other God. There's only one God. He is the infinite, the eternal, the sovereign, the almighty God. And we're not to place anyone before Him. He is the sovereign God. And therefore that law arises out of who He is, what He is. It arises out of His nature. Think of the commandment, thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor. That law is derived from God's nature. It's derived from who He is and what He is. God is truth. There is no darkness in Him at all. There's no falsehood in God. God can never countenance falsehood. And therefore, when He says we are not to bear false witness, that is arising out of His nature. Such laws are unchangeable. They are unalterable. Because God's nature cannot change. I am the Lord. I change not. Those laws never change. Because they're based on God's nature. God will never be anything else but truth. And God will never be anything but the sovereign, eternal, infinite, almighty God. So that therefore those laws remain unchanged and unalterable. But there is a second group of laws that are what we might describe as sovereign laws. They are laws and duties that are derived from God's sovereign will. They're laws that are given to us, not arising out of God's nature, but out of His will, His sovereign pleasure. And those laws may be changed. And those laws may be altered, if God is so pleased to alter them. I think the greatest example of that is found in the ordinances belonging to the Old Testament era. Think of the law concerning animal sacrifices. The children of Israel commanded to sacrifice the Passover lamb on the 14th day of the first month. You can think of all the other sacrifices and feasts that were required. You can think of the distinction between clean and unclean meats. They were only allowed to eat certain meats. They were to abstain from other meats. You can think of the ordinance of circumcision. And those laws are derived not so much from God's nature, but from God's sovereign will. God's sovereign pleasure. Take, for instance, Genesis chapter 17. If you turn to that, this is the first instance here where God required circumcision. And think of all the generations that have been beforehand. And yet it's only at this time that God introduces this requirement, this law, for Abraham and for his offspring. Genesis 17 and verse 10. Or verse 9, the Lord said unto Abraham, thou shalt keep my covenant. Therefore thou and thy seed after thee in their generations, this is my covenant which ye shall keep between me and you, and thy seed after thee, every man child among you shall be circumcised, and ye shall circumcise the flesh of your foreskin, and it shall be a token of the covenant betwixt me and you. You can see just how strong this command was in verse 14, and the uncircumcised man-child whose flesh of his foreskin is not circumcised, that soul shall be cut off from his people. He hath broken my covenant. See the consequences that came from this? There was a moral obligation for this to be fulfilled by the natural descendants of Abraham. And if that obligation was not met, then that soul would be cut off from all the covenant privileges that God gave to Abraham and to the seed of Israel. It's a command, but it's only introduced at this point in time. It had not been given by God prior to this. It was reaffirmed in the book of Exodus, chapter 12. when God gave command concerning the Passover, Exodus chapter 12 and verse 43, the Lord said unto Moses and Aaron, this is the ordinance of the Passover, there shall no stranger eat thereof. And that means one who is born outside of the family of Israel. No stranger shall eat thereof, but every man's servant that is bought for money, when thou hast circumcised him, then shall he eat thereof. A foreigner and an hired servant shall not eat thereof. In one house shall it be eaten. Thou shalt not carry forth aught of the flesh abroad out of the house, neither shall ye break a bone thereof. All the congregation of Israel shall keep it, and when a stranger shall sojourn with thee and will keep the Passover to the Lord, let all his males be circumcised, and then let him come near and keep it. And he shall be as one that is born in the land, for no uncircumcised person shall eat thereof. One law shall be to him that is homeborn, and unto the stranger that sojourneth among you. You see, this command is now given in relation to the Gentile, one born outside of the family of Abraham and Israel, has to be circumcised if he's going to keep the Passover and be brought in and made a member and a participant and a recipient of all the covenant blessings. You see, the command is reaffirmed here. But then when you come to Acts chapter 15, the great problem that had arisen in the early church concerning those who were teaching the necessity for Gentile converts in the New Testament era to be circumcised. Verse 1 of Acts 15, and certain men which came down from Judea taught the brethren and said, except ye be circumcised after the manner of Moses, ye cannot be saved. Here's a very firm declaration. You cannot be saved unless they're circumcised. And so this matter came to the council of apostles and elders, and they sat to discuss this matter, and after their discussion, the mind of the Lord became clear to them. And they sent letters to the Gentile churches. Verse 19. Here James speaks and he says, wherefore my sentence is that we trouble not them which from among the Gentiles are turned to God, but that we write unto them that they abstain from pollutions of idols and from fornication and from things strangled and from blood. And this pleased the assembly, the presbytery. And so they sent the letter, and they said to them in verse 24, for as much as we have heard that certain which went out from us have troubled you with words, subverting your soul, saying ye must be circumcised and keep the law, to whom we gave no such commandment. It seemed good unto us, being assembled with one accord, to send chosen men unto you with our beloved Barnabas and Paul. Verse 28, for it seemed good to the Holy Ghost and to us to lay upon you no greater burden than these necessary things, that ye abstain from meats offered to idols, and from blood, and from things strangled, and from fornication, from which, if ye keep yourselves, ye shall do well. Fare ye well. So you see how what was given as a requirement in the Old Testament era to Abraham and his descendants is now no longer required among Gentile converts in the New Testament era. The law has changed. And the same is true for all the Levitical requirements, the distinction between clean and unclean meats, the Levitical sacrifices and priesthood. We're not required to go up to Jerusalem three times every year to observe those feasts of the Lord given under the Levitical economy. Those requirements are no longer in force. Hebrews chapter 7. And verse 12, Paul makes this abundantly clear. And he says that with the coming of Christ into the world and his incarnation, his death and his resurrection, There was therefore a need for the law to be changed. Hebrews 7 and verse 12. For the priesthood being changed, that is, Christ being a priest, not after the Levitical order, not after the line of Aaron, but according to Melchizedek, Christ came from the tribe of Judah. And therefore the priesthood is changed. For the priesthood being changed, there is made of necessity a change also of the law. So here we have a transition in the law. And that transition manifests the sovereignty of God. This change wasn't in relation to natural laws or laws derived from God's nature. It was a change of sovereign laws, laws that are based on God's pleasure. The change of which does not affect God's nature. The transition has occurred. The Sabbath has changed from being observed on the last day of the week to being observed on the first day of the week. The ceremonial requirements have changed. The offerings, the feasts, the distinction in meats, they've all changed. And the Lord has brought in new ordinances, baptism and the Lord's table. There's a change. And the very change of the law reflects the sovereignty of God. Natural laws are holy, just and good, and therefore they are commanded. Sovereign laws are commanded, therefore they are holy, just and good. Natural laws are unalterable and therefore perpetually binding. They never change. Sovereign laws are alterable, and God may alter them whenever he pleases, but until he does so, they continue to be of immutable obligation. And those sovereign laws, they reveal God's sovereignty. It's not for us to say, "What doest thou?" It's for us to do as God has said. To do as God has said. Because he is sovereign. The Lord is pleased to remove the requirement of circumcision and the Levitical economy and introduce a new economy in the New Testament era. It is because he is sovereign. Because he's sovereign. He's the supreme lawgiver. So we see his sovereignty in the testimony of the law and in the transition of the law. But we see his sovereignty also in the transgression of his law. Transgression is not only the breaking of God's law, it is rebellion against God's sovereignty and his authority over us. It's a man's statement that God is not sovereign over his life, that man is his own God. And how foolish that statement is. Man's rebellion does not lessen the fact of God's sovereignty. It doesn't change his authority over us. It doesn't change man's accountability to God. It will merely bring the transgressor to a place where he will learn in a fearful way the truth of God's sovereignty. For it will bring him to hell. It'll bring him to hell. The Lord said in Revelation 1 verse 18, "I have the keys of hell and death." And the symbolism there in the keys is that of authority. I have the authority to open or close. And he has the authority to take the transgressor of his law and cast that transgressor into hell. But not only has he the authority, he has the ability. Remember what he said to the disciples when he was sending them out through Israel to preach the gospel? In Matthew 10 and verse 28, he said, "Fear not them which kill the body, but are not able to kill the soul. But rather fear him which is able to destroy both soul and body in hell. He not only has the authority, he has the ability. He is the king. And he has the power to put all rebels, all transgressors, into the prison house of hell. And when that last day comes, that great judgment day, the wicked will be judged according to his law, according to their transgression of his law. And the judgment that follows will be the evidence, the manifestation of the sovereignty of God. He is the supreme ruler. He decrees how we're to live. He decrees what is right and what is wrong. And the transgression of that law, if it remains unconfessed and unrepented of, it will receive the judgment of the king, the eternal perdition that the king will bestow and will reward the wicked with. But how do we apply this to ourselves as believers? How does the sovereignty of God in his law relate to us? Well, I think I can use the words of Paul much every way. You see, the church is the opposite of the world. The world is in rebellion against a God who is sovereign. The world is saying, we will not have this man to reign over us. And the way in which it says that is by transgressing the law of the king. But the church is to be the opposite of a rebellious world. The church is in submission to the king. The church has yielded to the authority of the king. And the way in which we yield to the authority of the king is by obeying his law. By obeying his law. How does the world manifest its its rebellion? By rejecting God's law. Doing as it pleases. How does the church manifest its submission to the heavenly king? By obeying God's law and receiving it as the rule of life. Turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 9. Notice how Paul inserts this statement here in the course of what he's saying. He's talking about his